Pure day, Wenda, you're not one on hope, pure day, Wenda, you're not one on hope, pure day, Wenda, you're not one on hope, Yanane, Amen. Pure day, Wenda, you're not one on hope, pure day, Wenda, you're not one on hope, pure day, Wenda, you're not one on hope, Yanane, Amen. Wichitanto, give me wa, Wanico, Rane, Yanane, no. Wichitanto, give me wa, Wanico, Rane, Yanane, no way. Wichitanto, give me wa, Wanico, Rane, Yanane, no. Wichitanto, give me wa, Wanico, Rane, Wanico, Rane, Wanico, Rane. Wichitanto, give me wa, Wanico, Rane, Yanane.
First stereotypes ever to hit the big screen was the Hollywood Indian.
The Shoshone boy now imprisoned by the United States Army for 3 years because he refused to go to Vietnam. His defense rested, and we assume the appeals will also, on one very simple point. The point is so simple, so glaringly simple, that it will probably be turned into a funny television series someday.
The Shoshone Nation, you see, is a foreign country. It was recognized by the United States government as such in all the treaties. And the young man fails to see why he, as a member of a foreign nation, should go to Vietnam to do to the Vietnamese what the white man has done to his people. The United States government tells him he's a citizen of the U.S. It's like conferring honorary citizenship on the French and then drafting their young men.
Hey, I got this funny idea, Harry. Yeah. You see, that this tribe of Indians.
I'm dying with laughter already.
Wait, this whole tribe of Indians, they decide they're not a part of the U.S. anymore.
That's a little far-fetched.
It doesn't matter, baby. It's funny, isn't it?
It's a scream.
All right, now, can't you dig it? Edward Everett Horton is the Polish Indian. Leo G. Carroll is the phony medicine man.
I'm dying with laughter.
Humorless, inscrutable, they would appear on a clifftop poised to descend on innocent settlers. And that was on a good day. Chief Dan George shattered that stereotype. He did it with complexity, humanity, and most radically, humor. When Hollywood beckoned, he'd already lived many lives as a father, a longshoreman, and a traveling showman. How did he turn his richly, at times roughly, textured life into both a test and a celebration of the spirit?
It's not personal glory that I'm looking for. It is the tradition of our Indian people, parents, to teach their children by example. That's what our Indian people need. Example of a native Indian doing what he's doing today.
He wanted us to be blessed with insight, with a kind of spiritual insight, which he felt, I think rightfully, that we as a nation had been lacking toward his people. And ultimately, our people.
Chief Dan George's heart soared like an eagle. He was a dock worker, musician, and grandfather who became a movie star. By bringing strength, skill, and integrity to his film and television roles, he transformed the Hollywood image of Native Indians that had so long oppressed his people.
He changed forever the way people think about us.
Chief Dan George was born in 1899 in the Chilwatoo territory, the son of a long line of chiefs. colonization reduced their territory of hundreds of miles to 1 square mile on a Burrard reserve, just a few miles of the Burrard Inlet from Vancouver, British Columbia. Dan grew up with the traditions of the Salish people and was nurtured by their strength.
He was the sixth child of Chief George Slechont and my grandmother Annie. They sort of given up hope of having a son. They had four daughters before they had any sons. And then Uncle Henry was born, and then my dad. Uncle Henry was such a blessing to the family that they paid more attention to him than to my dad. I don't know if he resented this or what, but the result of the way he became, whatever he'd done, he wanted not only to be good at it, but the best.
Such a strong man, physical too, almost unbelievable. I think because of the way he grew up, the food they ate. They went fishing when there was fish, and they ate the clams and crabs, and there was still oysters in here.
We learned how to use the bow and arrow. We shot squirrels and birds, and later on, as we got older, we made stronger bows that we used to use to get blue grouse on the hills just back here.
Dan would go to residential school where he learned the Catholic religion, but he would never let go of who he was.
He was in his heart and in his mind, just through and through, his whole spirit was First Nations person. Like, the reason it was the residential schools were built, they said, well, kill the Indian and save the man. I think that didn't happen to him in his heart and in his mind. He knew who he was.
Howdy there, colorful replica of America's past. When is the exciting in its primitive splendor snake dance going to take place?
It's usually in August, but with all our children off in Indian school, there's no one left to do the ceremonies.
Hiya, Pop.
I'm home.
Hello, Soaring Eagle. It's good to have you back from school.
Oh, come on. Call me Eddie. I'm an American now.
What have they been teaching you?
Just what we need for a better life. French horn, Italian, water polo.
Yes, at the Custer Memorial Indian School, Eddie's one of our prize students. We're giving him away next week.
Tell us more about your grandfather. How did he end up becoming such a prominent voice for First Nations communities?
We're so happy to have this exhibit being shown of Grandpa's work and the things that he has done back in a time where it was not cool to be a Native person in Canada. Residential schools were still open, and a lot of heartache in First Nations communities. That was the time where he went out and spoke to non-Indigenous people of who we really are and how this was affecting us. He's shown a light that a lot of people did not view us as.
He was placed in a residential school. What impact did that have on him? Did you ever know?
Yes, I did. I knew that Grandpa went to residential school, as well as my parents did. And the effects of it was great, you know, having not be in a home as a whole, as a family, and having a lot of the language not be present.
And did that lead him to the fight that he would lead later on, do you think?
Absolutely. I think that had a big part in how he thought it was important to share who we are in places that he would not normally be invited to go speak.
He was an Indigenous actor at a time when there were so many stereotypes of Aboriginal people on screen. What did he do that was different?
I remember stories of my mom saying that he would come home and kind of say to Grandma, this kind of isn't fair because they asked me to play this Native chief. And I just went on as himself. He kind of thought it was funny that He was asked to do this role, and pretty much he did just portray himself.
And were all of the roles, though, like that? I mean, did he ever get a role that would have been not typecast as, you know, a sort of traditional Indigenous person?
No, in all the roles that he did do, there was definitely a sparkle of himself that he portrayed.
Dad went to work as a logger and continued to hunt and fish like his grandfathers. The city of Vancouver was so close, he could often be found in the audience of vaudeville shows or the movies. Before long, he found someone he could share his life with. He married Amy Jack in 1918. Amy was from the Squamish Nation, a few miles down at Burrard Inlet. She, too, was from a long line of chiefs.
I used to tease my dad that behind every good man is a woman, and he'd say, "I don't argue with that." He says, "It's the truth." He said, "If I didn't have Mama, I wouldn't be where I am." If she said stop, he stopped.
He was always, like, trying to impress her, too. Like, I remember one New Year's, we had about 3 feet of snow, slippery. Well, New Year's Eve, 11 o'clock or something, the snow turned to ice, and he had one bullet for his shotgun. He's going to shoot it off for Mom at midnight. It must have been about 5 minutes to 12 when he, "Get your gun now, Dan." "Yeah, okay." And he goes running, he's loading it up, and he goes run outside. Right down to the where there usually is stairs, but it was just slippery ice. He's running down there. "What time is it now?" 3 minutes to 12. Oh, he says, "Down." "Not yet," she says.
It seems we were always laughing whenever he came across something that happened to him. I remember that time when we used to go swimming every summer, and we were all begging him, "Come swimming with us, Daddy, this time." He said, "Oh, okay." So we all went down to the beach, and we kept waiting for him and waiting for him. We wondered why he didn't come. So when we came up, Mum was laughing, and Dad looked really angry. He was standing at the sink. And we said, "Daddy, how come you didn't come swimming with us?" And right away, Mum started to laugh. She said he had his bathing suit was hanging out on the porch, and when he put it on, there was bumblebees. Three bumblebees, and they all took turns stinging him right on his behind.
"Well, Mr. President, it's the bees and spiders again. They stole my food stamps and sold them to the rats, and I tried to get down to my car for to honk the horn for help, but the snakes is gardening for the cockroaches. I go back upstairs, but the spiders is jammed the police lock. I ain't been inside for a week, and I know that my wife is sleeping with the bees."
Their life together began happily. Amy moved from Squamish to live with Dan at the Burrard Reserve, where he was born. They would have 8 children: Betty, Glenna, Bob, Rose, Anne, Irene, Amy Marie, and Leonard. They lost Betty and Glenna.
I asked him one day, I said, "Daddy, how do you remember what you have to say, your script?" And he said, "I pray to Betty. I say, 'Betty, honey, these people are paying Daddy lots of money, so help me to give them their money's worth.'"
All right, Nancy, go on with your story. Start with your dreadful secret.
"Oh, Nick, I can't. I'm so confused."
"Well, why don't you just hold your thumb next to your line? See, like this. Huh? This way I don't get confused and I never lose my place."
I feel faint. The whole world is spinning."
"Why, that's lucky for us, Nancy. If it were flat, all the Chinese would fall off."
He was 41 when he finally got to stand in front of an audience at a concert. And it was my mom that arranged this. She started what they call the Hillbilly Band. group with string instruments and a piano and drums. And she told Dad, you're going to be the MC.
And as soon as the curtain opened and all the people were out there, like, you know, it wasn't so small in Indian Hall, he knew everybody, but it was like opening to a crowd to him. And he went blank.
And every time he'd go to the mic, he couldn't find his script or he couldn't find his glasses. And they thought it was all part of his act, and they were just laughing.
Everybody's just killing themselves laughing, like they're just going, they're laying on the floor. They figured, like, it's all part of the act, right? And then he started to laugh with them, too, like, up on a stage. And then when he started to laugh, they laughed harder, so he laughed. And then he finally got down to his program. But, you know, I think it was from that moment on, that they just loved to entertain, loved to be out there.
Through laughter and music, love and prayer, the family endured. Then, in the early 1950s, Dan was seriously injured on the docks. Denied compensation, Amy and Dan were determined the family would survive.
She said, we'll take the band on tour. And called everybody together, and within a week, they made a decision. We unloaded all the dry goods we had out of our house and loaded up two rickety old cars we had and packed our families in and took off for the interior. And she made us rehearse. She made us be good. Sometimes we'd play in non-native communities, but mostly it was on the reservation halls after the rodeo. We put on a floor show with our traditional songs and dances before the dance, and then we play for the dance.
Hey, how much is that necklace you're wearing?
Do you know how to do the war dance?
Hold it. Smile.
Isn't it amazing how they survive on this stinking desert?
You got any scalps?
Hey, let me get a shot of you and your squaw.
Hey, let's see the war dance.
Let's see the dance.
Let's see the dance.
Dance.
Let's
dance.
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 Okay, okay, folks. Fun's over. Back in the bus.
Sometimes we had to drive from that dance to another dance and sleep a little, then start over again. I don't know how he did it. We were like gypsies. It was one of the happiest times of my life.
We have with us as our first mystery guest of the evening, Craig, one of the messengers for the traditional Indians in this land. And what we want to get into right away is a little bit of the history behind the receiving of this spirit message, this spirit poem, so that people can get a further understanding of what's really going on. Because to some who turned in late, I suppose, they were hearing, in a sense, kind of what sounded like a translation poem, you know. It made sense, but they didn't know precisely why. How did it all come about, Craig?
Well, for a long time, we've been looking for live gypsies. We know that gypsies have prophetic instructions just like we do. In fact, all traditional people do, as far as we know. But we weren't able to find any. Recently in San Francisco, we talked with an old lady and asked her if the gypsies of San Francisco were preparing to get out of town and get back to their wild, free life that belongs to them. And she said, no, we've gotten here now, we've become fat and lazy, we'll die here with the corrupt ones, the white people. And she says, I remember the wild, free days when the earth was clean and the air was beautiful. But she says, I'll never see it again. I said, how about those people in Los Angeles? Do you know any gypsies down there that are alive, that are looking towards the future and preparing for the future? And she said, there may be some, but I don't know of any. We've just become fat and lazy, that's all. Well, it was on Halloween Day, and I had a feeling something significant would happen on Halloween, because it has in the past 2 years. Something significant has happened on Halloween as far as the Indian situation is concerned here. Got this phone message. A gypsy was receiving automatic writing. He didn't like it. He didn't understand it. It pertained to Indians, about which he knew nothing. And he wanted me to come and talk with him about it. So he read me the poem, and it tied in with things that have been happening within the past 3 days or 4 days and tied in so closely that it really excited me. It really encouraged me to go ahead and do things that had been started and left kind of shelved temporarily. So I found a live gypsy. He lamented over the fact that his people were becoming fat and lazy, that they're even turning into Christians. And he says, the Christianity they're turning to isn't a traditional Christianity, something that has power or roots. He says they're becoming holy rollers. He says, I know of only one other gypsy besides myself that still looks to the traditions. He said, there may be others, but he said, I only know of the two of us. So at least he found a live one, and it's been years. We've been looking for years, you know.
Well, you not only got a live one, you got one that was chosen to translate or to, in a sense, work as the medium for a very important message. What did the message mean to you? What do you think was the basis of it? Who do you think gave it and why? You know, what's the whole paraphernalia behind it?
Well, judging from the information the gypsy got, which corroborated information I'd received the same night that the gypsy received it. Now, I was several hundred miles from Los Angeles at the time, and I was awakened at 2 o'clock in the morning with a whole bunch of very enthusiastic type thoughts, but I'd been wakened by the spirit before at 2 o'clock in the morning, and I'd written down the things that I thought were significant, but by dawn's early light, they looked pretty impractical. So after he had me hopped up there for about an hour, telling me things about where communities should be established and how to start and so forth, I said, please go away and leave me alone. This all sounds great here in the middle of the night, but I know that from past experience, when it becomes daylight again, it's not gonna look too practical. So please go away and leave me alone. So he did. He left me just about 3 o'clock. I went to sleep, and at 3 o'clock he came down here and woke this gypsy up and started writing through him, turning out in greater detail the things he'd been telling me up at the base of this magic mountain.
I have received no answer.
Right.
Now, like I say, the gypsy had no experience with Indians at all, and yet the symbology there, this black and white feather, for instance, that was one of the most popular icons or symbols of the ghost dance. And as I walked in the door, he says, what does a black and white feather falling into the night mean? And I said, I don't know, but to me it means that the ghost dance has gone into eclipse. It's gone into darkness. It's not active. And so then we read the poem and found out that it not only fell into the night, but it's now falling out of the night. And that this would be a literal symbol, the black and white feather, this magpie feather falling out of the night. And we've had a couple of them since then. They just fall. You'd be walking along and there'd be this black and white feather drop down in front of you.
And now you know what it means, baby, when you walk down the street and get a black and white feather on the street. Oh, Lord, the time has come.
The ghost dance people are going to be coming back.
The ghost dance, which in very bad paraphrase is the dance that sprang up because of Wovoka, was it not?
Yes.
And Wovoka was a great Indian, American Indian mystic, religious leader, inspired man. What was he, and what did he do, and how did it end?
He's not just a mystic and a meditator, not just an inspired man, but he was also a miracle worker. A man by the name of Paul Bailey wrote a book about Wovoka in which he makes fun of the miracles there because he didn't understand them. But the people who experienced these miracles up near Shores, Nevada, people who knew Wovoka, people whose lives had been saved by the power that backed up or worked with Wovoka, they know better. So they're pretty upset about Paul Bailey's book. I'm pretty upset about Paul Bailey's book, too, because I'm convinced that Wovoka was a genuine prophet in our time. And the message he gave, he was out of the body for several days, by the way, before he came back with his message for these times. That is to say, about 1890 onward. The message he gave was also accompanied with the prophecy that Indians from all over would come to hear this message. And it turned out to be true because in those days, in spite of the wars with Uncle Sam, most of us still had free passage on railways. Railway right-of-ways had been put through Indian territories with the understanding that Indians could ride for free on railroads. And so this was taken advantage of, and Indians did come from all over. Some people misinterpreted the instructions and the prophecies that Wovoka gave them. Others understood. Some were impatient and thought it was happening right away, that the great seas of mud and the other signs that would destroy this Mammonist or Babylonian so-called civilization that were supposed to come in the spring were to be the next spring, 1891 or thereabouts. But of course it didn't mean that. It meant the spring of the new era, the new day, the new,
which is fast
dawn.
Coming upon us.
Which is here now, yeah, it's coming. I mean, it's here in embryo.
The hill next to us fell apart a couple of days ago. That's because it was built by the deputy chief of police. But aside from that, it's still fundamentally a sign.
Yeah, its foundations are crumbling, that's true.
But the ghost dance reached its end in the massacre at Wounded Knee.
Oh, no. No. Ghost dances are still going on, and people still remember. It isn't talked about openly. Hasn't been. It's not coming out more into the open. And this wave of dark people rising up, the context in which it's used leads me to believe it's the people of Oklahoma who will be coming alive again. Because most of those people there are displaced people. I'm speaking now of Indian people. People who have pretty well forgotten their traditions because they're not on their own homelands. And they therefore do not have the visible symbols to identify with and remember their prophetic instructions with. But things are happening in Oklahoma now. And it looks to me like they will revive. And there's a great day coming.
Well, one of the things that runs through this spirit poem is the connection between those of feather and those of bead.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, I was pretty upset about the hippie movement. We all know that life progresses actively, then there's a little period of sleep or rest, and then it takes another step. And from the beatnik movement, there's a little resting period, then it built up in the hippie movement, and the resting period came, and I didn't like to see that. I wanted to make a bigger step that time. But the resting period seems to be here. I was concerned as to what we might be able to do to prepare for the next period of activity. Was it really going to die? No. But what could we do to help out? Well, this poem mentions hippies, too, as I see it, and ties it in even more closely with the traditional Indian movement here, which makes me happy, because we're all in this thing together. And I like to have this gypsy coming in on the scene and confirming the thoughts that I was hoping for, and encouraging us along that line. I'm going to be awful glad when the gypsies become active with us, because those people really got power.
I went to see the gypsy, staying in a big hotel. He smiled when he saw me coming, and he said, well, well, well. His room was dark and crowded. Lights were low and dim. How are you? He said to me. I said it back to him. I went down to the lobby to make a small call out. A pretty dancing girl was there, and she began to shout, go on back to see the gypsy. He can move you from the rear, drive you from your fear, bring you through the mirror. He did it in Las Vegas, and he can do it here. Outside the lights were shining on the river of tears. I watched him from the distance with the music in my ears. I went back to see the gypsy. It was nearly early dawn. But the gypsy was gone, and that pretty dancing girl, she could not be found. So I watched that sun come rising from a little Minnesota town, from that little Minnesota town.
They became known as Chief Dan George and his Indian entertainers. They toured every summer from 1957 to 1967.
In Vancouver, he got to be known as the rock and roll chief. His feature song was Party Doll.
In 1960, the CBC in Vancouver created a bold new television series about the life on the high ranchlands of British Columbia. Written by Paul St. Pierre and directed by Phil Keatley, Caribou Country was ahead of its time, casting Indians to play Indians.
I got a phone call from CBC asking if I would like to work on a television series. Oh, sure, I said, and go to Hollywood after. I thought they were just bugging me in. So they explained. I said, well, okay.
It's a long time I don't see you, Smith.
Yeah. The years go by, Gabriel.
Makes me scared.
I was working with an elderly man. And he became ill.
I don't feel so good.
And they couldn't continue.
Got only one door.
So I kept telling Phil Keatley, try my dad. He was about 57 years old at the time.
Gabriel figures might be you'll help him so they don't kill him on that rope.
And after they seen him, the first film on TV, they wrote him in on the rest of the series.
We were very worried that we'd upset him by the fact that, you know, he surrounded by all this technology and gear, and he'd get upset. And so we eased him into it, not knowing, of course, that his entire childhood had been spent in the gallery of the Orpheum Theater, watching every vaudeville show that came to town, every play that he knew more movies than I ever knew. He was a complete, he was a man who loved theater, loved song and dance. And of course, the other thing is that I'd never realized the tradition of storytelling among his people is so strong. I mean, he'd been listening to storytellers as the center of his life and the history of his people all his life. And here I am worried about whether you'll have a sense of the theatrical when we get him on camera. You know, he was wonderful.
The gleaming futuristic design of the General Motors Pavilion contrasts sharply with the show inside, a dramatized West Coast Indian legend.
The night was alive with great dances and great stories of Hulk, the bird who used his long beak to crack men's skulls and then suck their brains out. Crooked beak, bird of heaven. Olmuque, king of the sea. Bokwas, the wild man of the woods. Solokwa, the woman who eats children. Nuasma, the fool dancer. Thunderbird, creator of lightning.
Now, reach out and grasp the pulsating red knob.
Okay.
And pull it firmly to animate the diorama.
Always pull a free knob.
How?
Wow.
I tell you how. Ancient Indian legends say 30 million moons ago, great god Kachu lived far to north in frigid New York.
Oh, come on.
One day, eat bad street dog.
I've done that.
Throw up. On world below, create rich soil.
Hammer Indian
in
nonsense.
This
knob's the sacrifice.